Tom Shadyac was one of Hollywood's go-to comedy directors for 13 years, and the 8 films he made, which included Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, The Nutty Professor, Liar Liar, and Bruce Almighty, grossed over $1.5 billion worldwide. But after a near-death experience in 2007, he gained a new perspective on his role as a filmmaker and public figure and the way he was living his life, and he began to focus on projects that might have a greater impact on society. In 2011, he released a documentary called I Am, where he explored the questions, what's wrong with the world and what can we do to fix it? Now, Mr. Shadyac has written a book that serves as something of a companion piece to this film. It's called Life's Operating Manual with Fear and Truth Dialogues. It's published by Hay House, and I'm very pleased that it brings Tom Shadyac to our show. Hello.
Hello. Good to be here.
In your documentary, I Am, you ask prominent spiritual and intellectual leaders the question, what's wrong with the world? And how would you answer that question?
Yeah, it's funny. The documentary started on, excuse me, kind of a negative arc. What's wrong with the world? And we ended up discovering what's right with it. But what's essentially gone wrong is we're not seeing things as they are. So we've created a paradigm based on half-truths about our overly competitiveness, our separateness. And that's why we have the world the way we have.
You say that this book was largely inspired by a near-death experience in 2007. What happened?
I got in a bike accident and developed post-concussion syndrome, which is a condition where the symptoms of a concussion simply don't go away.
Is this the sort of thing that we've been seeing with football players?
Exactly. Same thing, hockey players, football players, impact sports. It's a brutal condition. You have to isolate yourself. The brain heals very slowly, and it's torturous to have any stimulus at all in your life.
So when you're stimulated, it actually causes you pain?
Yeah,
is that why you seriously considered committing suicide?
I didn't consider committing suicide. I wasn't suicidal, but I thought that I couldn't go on like this, that I would be on the last chapter of my life.
So how do you treat this? Does traditional medicine have any treatments?
Traditional medicine was very closed-minded in their approach to this. They told me that I likely would not get better. Alternative medicine helped quite a bit, and rest. You literally have to shut down all stimuli. I slept in a closet. I did alternative treatments, and over time, I healed.
And you use biofeedback?
Biofeedback, hyperbaric oxygen.
What does that do? It puts extra oxygen into the brain?
Exactly. It forces oxygen into the cells. They use it now for all kinds of athletic injuries, from sprained ankles to surgical recoveries and brain injuries.
You write a lot about letting go. Well let me go back to that. Since those things seem to work for you, have you spoken to traditional doctors about them as alternatives to the methods they've been using?
Well, I don't really have a clear path of communication to those traditional doctors, but I certainly speak loudly about it when I speak to audiences and people who have brain injuries. Now I tell them that don't listen to that idea, that there is a way out of this and you can heal.
You write a lot about letting go and say that that's one of the secrets of directing films.
Yeah.
How so?
Well, most people think directing is about being in control, and I think a great directing comes from listening. Morgan Freeman was once given advice when he became a director from John Avildsen. He said, "Help me, John. What can I learn from you?" And he said, "I'd sum it up in one word: listen. Listen to your actors. Listen to the material." So in some ways, it's out of control. You let go of control, and then something controls you, and that's art.
Well, film is one of the most collaborative of all the arts. But in the end, somebody has to make the final decision.
Right. But that decision can come from a closed-minded director. It can come from an open-spirited director, where you can take an idea from anyone. And if my films have had any success at all, it's because I'm open to the ideas and the creativity of others.
How did the idea of letting go relate to your recovery process?
Oh, yeah. That's a really potent question. First of all, I had to let go of what I should be feeling. And the idea that I should be feeling better, that I shouldn't be having this pain, when I let that go, it did release a tension. And I realized, I got this from reading some Eckhart Tolle, that this just what is at the moment. This is only the way it is right now. It's not going to necessarily be like this tomorrow. And that definitely released the tension between fighting what was occurring and what I thought should be occurring.
And then on another level, you let go a lot of your material things.
Yeah, but I let go of those things beforehand. It's one of the misunderstandings. I probably didn't communicate as well, as effectively as I needed to in the film. I had been letting go of stuff well before my accident. I had been on a journey discovering the truth and the power of service and sharing, the resources that had come to me.
Well, at the beginning, you start moving up. Your rate as a director became exponentially larger with each film that you worked on. You say you were paid $140,000 for directing Ace Ventura in 1994. By 2003, you were paid $30 million for Bruce Almighty.
Oh, my goodness.
That made you uncomfortable?
I wasn't paid that up front. I my fee at the time was around $8 million.
Yeah, and then you got a
percentage
million. Of the gross.
Yeah, I got a percent of the gross. It did really well. No, it never felt right from the time I did Liar Liar. It just didn't feel right. You know, you break it down to food. If I have this much food at my table and others are hungry, why can't we all be eating?
Did it bother you that your films rarely got great reviews from the critics as long as they were doing so well at the box office?
You might as well ask, are you human? Yeah, I'm human. And so, you know, many of us artists always, the 99 are saying wonderful and the one is saying you're terrible. We tend to listen to that guy. So I'm growing out of that, but I'm still human.
Well, in the end, you were making films that were meant to have a mass appeal.
I'm making films that move me. So I don't ever, make a film for the masses. I make a film that might entertain me or might give me some sense of humor or thought.
At the height of your time, of your Hollywood career time, which was also the height of your consumption. You lived in a house in Pasadena that had 17 bedrooms, 13 bathrooms, a full staff who maintained the pool, tennis courts, landscaping. Did you need all those bedrooms and bathrooms? Did you have a lot of people stay with you?
No. No, it's just kind of what you did.
What happened to those bedrooms? Did they just
closed? Literally, I had ghosts in this house. It was an old haunted house, and at least someone was staying in the rooms. No, I didn't. Of course, I didn't need. Who needs 17 bathrooms? Every now and then, family would come in. Yeah, you would need it for one weekend out of the year. But, I mean, look around. We don't have a homeless problem. We have a heartless problem. You know, I mean, there's so many empty bedrooms around us. It's a matter of perspective, and I was kind of asleep.
So how does that lifestyle compare to the way you live today?
I live very different today. No one should feel sorry for me. I live in a mobile home park, but it's cost money to live there. But it's definitely out of the paradigm. I live simply. I take what I need. I argue, only for what I need now on a picture. I don't, quote, get my market value, and I try to create an account for others, and then we can all hopefully do well.
Now, I was suggesting earlier that the accident was something of an awakening, but you say the awakening had occurred a little earlier?
Yeah, it was a series of shocks along the way. Yeah, where you get, like, when I got my first big paycheck after Nutty Professor, Liar, Liar, and it just, something didn't feel right about it. You know, I'm privileged to be an artist, and I almost felt like maybe I should be paying them to do what I do, and others who work as hard or harder, who are suffering may need this more than I.
And you were already getting involved with social and environmental causes in your films. In fact, maybe there's been a message in all of the films.
Oh, every one of my films has had something. Even Ace Ventura was a respect for the natural world. I liken them to little parables. I think it's important when you're doing art, for me, to send some kind of a thought, a good energy into the world. Woody Allen used to say, if you want to send a message, send it Western Union.
I think that was Samuel Goldwyn.
But Woody was quoting him. But that's a message. Even when you're sending a message about you don't like messages, you're still sending a message. So you might as well stand for something that represents something you stand for.
And didn't you say you were committed to making Evan Almighty a carbon neutral film? How do you do that?
Well, there's no such thing as an energy neutral film because we haven't figured that out yet. But you do the best you can to calculate your carbon footprint and then plant trees.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you plant trees, which will sequester the carbon.
Because you still have to fly in airplanes and
absolutely.
Drive cars.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then you calculate that, and then you do a tree planting calculation.
Well, there are cynics who say, not of you, but of...
There are cynics of me.
How much are the green measures that are touted by the business community really a matter of just getting good PR?
Well, I think that is a cynical question. I think you have to go to the intention of someone. Ray Anderson was one who was in the film I Am, and he his intentions were pure. He was trying to turn his carpet industry and factory and plant. He wanted to be respectful of nature. And so I think you have to go to the intention. And we're imperfectly moving through this, but there are some that are doing it with a good heart, pure spirit.
My guest is Tom Shadyac, Shadyac. His book, Life's Operating Manual, with the Fear and Truth Dialogues, and we'll get to those in a moment. Did you find that were people in Hollywood looking at you as a good model or good role model?
I don't know if I was anyone's role model, good or bad. I there was some reaction to me as extreme, or maybe I had gone off the deep end. But, you know, after some years and seeing the light in my eye, actually, I think getting brighter, I hope, they've seen there's maybe something to what I'm talking about.
Well, you dedicated some of your wealth to charitable causes, like opening a homeless shelter in Charlottesville, Virginia. Also, you've made donations to preserve natural landscapes. How much of a dent can one person make?
Infinite. The energy that one puts out, whether they give money, time, resources, talent, a kind word, the ripple effect is scientific and it's infinite. And that's the misconception, that we all have to be Bill Gates giving billions of dollars, starting world-changing programs, when we don't realize the second we reach out in a changed act, in kindness, the world changes.
Now, you said this is not something that you just came to yourself. You actually had a father who encouraged this kind of thinking.
Yeah. My dad helped to found St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, which is a charity which gives, fully dedicated to eradicating cancer, and it gives its product away for free.
How much did your religious beliefs inform the changes that you've made in your lifestyle?
Everything and nothing. So the spirit of the religion was beautiful, meaning I was raised Catholic and, you know, love your neighbor, do unto others. Don't store up treasures on earth. Those were beautiful moral philosophies that resonated with me since I was a boy. The exclusivity of the faith and the faiths never interested me. So I moved away from the dogma and more into the spirit.
Well, why do you think religion hasn't played a bigger role in bringing about positive changes in the world? The Catholic Church definitely talks about helping the poor. On the other hand, we hear many people on the religious right opposing government programs like food stamps and health care reform.
Well, first of all, I would say that it's not accurate to say that religion hasn't played a role in doing great things for the world. They have many, many, many charity projects, charitable causes have been started by religions. But
I said a bigger role. I didn't say a role.
Yeah, I would say because religions are populated by humans. And right now, we're humming to this idea. What's wrong with the world is, again, the question I've posed and I am, which is not akin with how things work, with how life works. We're all kind of collectively asleep. It's what the mystics and Emerson and others talked about.
Well, but religions actually have at their core generosity, love for the downtrodden. Pretty much every religion does. None says, I'm on top, so the hell
I understand,
with you.
But this is the hypocrisy that we all face. On Sunday, we say love thy neighbor, and then on Monday, we go in and say, how can I beat my neighbor? How can I take advantage of my neighbor and make a profit? That's what has to come together.
Well, when you were competing for a job, when you were being considered for whether you would direct a film or somebody else would, or whether you were trying to get money for a film, weren't you being very competitive yourself?
I never really had that spirit. No. I've grown some, but my philosophy has always been, and I hope I've been stronger in that philosophy. It's been do your best, show yourself for all that you are. But I really feel that another director can be better at a film even that I'm attached to, I'd rather he do it. I really would. I just want the best for art and for the culture. And so I don't want to compete in that sense. I want to be all that I can be.
You've structured the book as a group of essays and a dialogue between two separate parts of your personality, truth and fear. How do you come to choose those voices to represent opposing worldviews?
Because they're all around me. When you talked about religion, where religion has, quote, gone wrong, it's because of fear. We're afraid. You know, the great religious leaders were not afraid to die. We're afraid, and so I have that fear in me. I fear the judgment of others. I fear being a social outcast. I have at times feared my own death. And as I face those things, I've moved out of fear. And so this brings the voice of truth louder in my life.
Is there any overlap between the two?
Of course, yeah. Fear informs where you ought to go. where fear's telling you not to go, you need to go. So they're brothers. It's like doubt is too lonely a pain to know that faith is his twin brother.
But I get the feeling that the voice of truth is really most in line with your own ideals. Was writing the voice of fear a little like playing devil's advocate?
Yeah, in a way. But remember, when I start the book out, I say I'm not claiming to have the whole truth and nothing but the truth. This is what I'm hearing now and how truth is working through me. And so fear is the voice that says what you're thinking is crazy. I hear it all the time. I was on a talk show this morning and they looked at me as if I had lost my mind. And the good news is I have lost my mind and I've found my heart.
What did you say that led them to think you'd lost your mind?
Just the idea that nature, for example, works through cooperation. We're so brainwashed to believe that Darwin was into this overly zealous idea of survival of the fittest. It wasn't even his phrase. Herbert Spencer came up with the phrase survival of the fittest. Darwin said it twice. He said the word love 95 times in The Descent of Man. But we don't see things as they are. We see them as we are. And because we are overly competitive, we see Darwin as overly competitive. And we don't see the loving side and the sympathetic side that he identified in the human species.
Well, you could go to pretty much any book, whether it's the Bible or Darwin or anything else, and if you want to find something that justifies your worldview, you'll find it.
Right. And the question is, forget my worldview. What is actually true? How does life work? That's what I try to talk about in the book. How have we, through science, through observation, experiment, etc., looked at life and seen how it actually thrives. And there are principles and laws laid out for us, and that's the operating manual.
In one of the conversations, you write that technology is neutral, that the same cell phone can connect a person in love or set off a car bomb. Technology is often blamed for bringing human interaction out of its natural context. Do you see it that way at all?
No, I don't blame technology. I blame the value behind technology. It's a tool. I can use a tool to hurt you, cut you, maim you, or I can use a tool to heal that knife to heal you.
But a lot of people also use it as a way to separate themselves from the rest of the world, sit in front of their computer
that's a value.
All day.
Again, that's a value. They have become separate. That's back to that question. What's wrong with the world? Oh, I'm just me, and I have nothing to do with the greater society at large.
Have you witnessed two kids, as I have, who sat side by side, connecting with each other, writing to each other on their computers, but they could have just turned and talked to each other?
Absolutely. I teach college, so I see this cost and gain every day. I see the gain of their texting someone, but they lose the value of the sunset in the distance. They lose the interaction with a fellow student nearby.
You believe that our cultural story explains why the world is in a broken state. What do you mean by our cultural story?
I didn't realize our culture was telling a story till I read this book called Ishmael by Daniel Quinn. It's this idea, and Morgan Freeman turned me onto it, who played God in Bruce Almighty. It's this idea that there's a cultural hum, just an ideology that you're not aware of that shows up everywhere. And when you look at it, you realize that you may have been programmed in a way. And the question is a cultural telling a story? Is the story true?
Well, you must have had ambition to become a director, didn't you? I mean, didn't you start as the youngest staff joke writer for Bob Hope?
I did. Yeah. Yeah.
You remember any of the jokes you wrote?
Not so funny now. Oh, the first jokes I wrote were about there was this woman, Morgana, who ran out onto the field. This is way back in 1980-something. Remember during the All-Star game, she would run out on the field. She was very buxom.
And she would kiss the athletes.
Exactly. I think I wrote a joke about the seventh inning stretch mark. Something very bad like that.
Yeah. But Bob must have liked it.
He must have, because I worked with him for 3 years, yeah.
But were you thinking all along, as the joke goes in Hollywood, what I really want to be is a director?
I didn't know I wanted to be a director till I went back to film school. I was a writer, a stand-up comic. I wrote some sitcoms, some screenplays. I sold my first screenplay, went back to film school, made a film, and that's when it hit me, that aha moment where, wow, this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
And what's the industry's reaction been to your awakening and transition?
Well, I don't think the industry speaks as one voice. So I've had friends that have been incredibly supportive and others that, again, think I'm a little left of center.
Well, you have done this documentary. Are you going to return to making big budget films?
Well, I don't, again, consider a film whether it's big budget or low budget. I consider the soul of a film, what it's saying, the story. And whether or not I think I could tell it well. So, yeah, I'm doing a couple films now. I'm doing a remake of The Untouchables with Harvey Weinstein and the Weinstein Company. And then I've also been hired to rewrite and direct another film.
Well, the Weinstein film is the biggest grossing film in America right now. It was done on a small budget. Everybody said that The Butler wasn't going to do well at all. Is Hollywood missing the boat there? They seem to be turning out certain kinds of movies that the public is turning up its noses at, and then it's responding to a film like The Butler.
We always miss the boat. We're always a little behind, just like politics, right? So show business isn't out ahead creating trends. We're waiting for you guys, for the audience to react, and that's where we go. Now, that's not necessarily where I hope I go. But when I did Ace Ventura, for example, a comedy like that with that sort of broad fearlessness hadn't been done ever. As soon as we did that and the audience responded, Hollywood ran to chase it. So now they'll run to chase films like The Butler and other smaller films because larger films haven't done well this summer. The big budget films have not done well.
Well, there's been a lot of – you haven't done any films with big explosions, have you?
No, I've done with some effects, but no, I don't know. No big explosions. No.
Well, the argument is now that Hollywood is making films for the international market. That's why 3D, explosions, little dialogue. And maybe they should also think about making films for Americans with clever dialogue.
Yeah, yeah. Again, I would. There are some really amazing people in show business, so I'd be remiss to categorize reticent to categorize show business people in one breath. There are some people that just simply want to do great films like The Butler and smaller films like that.
Tom Shadyac's book, Life's Operating Manual, with the Fear and Truth Dialogues. It is published by Hay House. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you, brother. Good to be here.